LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Jason Horsley, who joins us to discuss his book, The Kubricon, The Cult of Kubrick, Attention Capture, and the Inception of AI. It's hardly controversial to suggest that the 24/7 mass media matrix in which untold millions are immersed might be doing much more harm than good. But what if this addictive, obsessive diet of gaudily lit screens and never-ending noise was actually the core of an agenda to mesmerize and manipulate humanity towards much darker ends? With our collective disconnect from reality already well underway, trash culture, sometimes disguised as art, is creating a subspecies for whom the distinction between fact and fiction will soon no longer exist. People with a susceptibility to being programmed, or even possessed, by outside influences. And the purpose? The harvesting of human sentience for the seeding of machine intelligence.
Hello and welcome, Jason. Thank you so much for joining us once again today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello, Greg.
Now, Jason, you've got a new book just out, something maybe a little bit of a surprise for those of us that have followed your work for a while, because we weren't sure if we're going to get any more books from you. This one's entitled The Kubricon, The Cult of Kubrick, Attention Capture, and the Inception of AI. Before we get started, just tell listeners who perhaps are not familiar with your work a little bit about yourself, just where you are at this point in time.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, I wasn't planning to write any more books because I've just moved to Spain, northern Spain, to do what I think is known as homesteading in the US. I don't know what we call it in Britain. It's not really farming as yet, but we do
crofting,
have
maybe.
Crofting.
Small holding.
Okay, these are terms are not familiar to me, nor is the lifestyle. But that's basically my trajectory now. I thought my last book was 16 Maps of Hell, which was self-published, with a rough draft of the exit was the footnote to the title, and that sort of speaks for itself. I think that my writing and podcasting career of about 30 years or something has been, certainly with hindsight, but somewhat consciously from the start, has been about mapping hell at all the levels that I could access cognitively, because if you're going to write it down as sentences, you have to have some cognitive access. So, from the personal to the political, the social, the parapolitical, the parasocial, but also the metaphysical, somewhat. I mean, when my early books, I had a pseudonym of A.L.S. Cephas, and I did get into metaphysical, but I don't really consider those early books to be very reliable, trustworthy as maps. And in my 40s, I embarked on a new trajectory as a writer, among other things, pretty much with Paper Tiger, I think, and then there was Seen and Not Seen and Prisoner Infinity and Vice of Kings and Dark Oasis, 60 Maps of Hell, and all these books are essentially what I just described there. It's just trying to get a sense of the landscape, the lay of the landscape, the invisible landscape, to steal a phrase from Terence McKenna, who I don't like or respect, but of malevolence, of organized malevolence, and as a way to extricate myself from complicity with that system, which, as I indicated, is not just, as I see it, not just social or societal, but metaphysical. And it by the same token, and what's even harder perhaps is extricate it from myself. So my books and my writing and my speaking and podcasting, and I currently run groups and do one-to-ones, they've all been oriented towards this process of becoming whole. It's just that it became more conscious in the last few years that I was writing because I had to write, and I had to write because something had been put in me or was controlling me that I needed desperately to get free from, and writing was one of the ways that I just instinctively gravitated towards. But it was really a means and not an end. So I don't consider my books or my podcasts particularly of value as artifacts, but as pointers, like as maps by which people can do the work themselves, but also begin the work just by observing closely somebody else who's doing the work, who's been doing it that much longer, let's say. I mean, I presume if they're not familiar, I mean, most people aren't familiar, I think. There's conspiracy theory, as you know all too well, and there's occultism, and there's various different disciplines or belief systems, but I consider them all pretty much what I call second matrix, which is another, I don't want to go off on another tangent there, but just to sum up there, that my view about these things is the mapping and the exploring and the describing is worthless unless it represents one's own journey to out of hell and back to natural existence. And thereby the work is rooted and grounded in that, so that it's not only effective for myself as a communicator, but also useful to others as something that's practical and experiential rather than just theoretical.
Okay, so the Kubrick mentioned in the title of the book is Stanley Kubrick, the film director. People, listeners, can't bring a film title to mind. This is the guy, 2001, The Space Odyssey, Clockwork Orange, The Shining, Eyes Wide Shut, just a few examples of his films that were, you know, picked up a more substantial audience. But this is Kubrick's just one example, really. You're talking throughout the book, and then again, a lot of your other work, about all the collective compounded effects of the culture and media that we're steeped in. What's behind that, where it comes from, what it's for. Regarding Kubrick, you said, I'm paraphrasing, you know, from the book, central to the thesis of the Kubrickon, but not only are Kubrick's movies not what they seem, but they are also not what a growing consensus of Kubrick revisionists claim they are. This is only a deeper, darker level of seeming, a second matrix, which again, you've just referred to. So why did you select Kubrick as a kind of, as an example on which to hang your other concepts and ideas? Is it just because he was such a, in some ways, extreme example of some of the phenomena that you're speaking about in culture?
Well, you just gave an introduction of Kubrick, and it occurred to me that if ever the phrase "this man needs no introduction" applied, it would be with Kubrick. Like, you can't really avoid having heard about Kubrick and even having some opinion about him if you're in the Western world, certainly if you're into mass media, anyway, culture. So that's number one. Like, he's a big fish. The fish that I've gone after in the past, well, they've been of varying sizes, for those who don't know. I mean, Whitley Strieber, for example, is a big fish in a small pond. Crowley, well, he's a very big fish in terms of influence, but he's still fairly marginal. Kubrick's just a big fish in a big pond. He's a worldly influence. Like, he's considered one of two or three most influential filmmakers, and cinema film is considered the most influential art form of the 20th century. I mean, it's recognized as such. So, and to me, most influential means most effective and most useful as propaganda. So it's inevitable. I mean, my first books were about movies, as a film critic, but even in those days of the Blood Poets, my first published books, I considered those books Trojan horses, as in a sense I consider all my books, and I wanted to use writing about film not just to express and explore my love of film back then, because I was really just in love with movies back then, but I was also aware of the parapolitical, the hidden metaphysical evil that was underneath the system, including Hollywood. So I wanted to use those books as a way not just to write about movies, but also to write about the aspects of society and existence that you can't really generally talk or write about. Certainly not in academia, I think, and not because it was an academic book. But I mean, you can, but not outside of a certain fringe areas like New Age and occultism and stuff like that. So I was trying to write a kind of mainstream thing, rather rashly or foolishly, I think. Anyway, Kubrick, he's a hugely influential figure, and he's always been on my radar because I've always been into movies. However, the question, why did I select Kubrick? I think the best answer is I didn't. As with all my books, pretty much, I think, at least in the phase that I just described, that I think is the meaningful work I've done. I don't think I ever chose to start writing a book, never mind what the subject was exactly. Well, there's two things going on there, because sometimes I did choose to write, like Prism Infinity, you could say, began as an essay about Willy Strieber. So I certainly did choose to write about Willy Strieber, but I didn't choose to write a book about him. I just, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually, okay, this has to be a book. I'm going to need a bigger boat, as they say in Jaws. And with Kubrick, it wasn't even that I wanted to write an article about Kubrick. Actually, it was just that he kept popping up, and it wasn't just in the movie. Like I wrote about movies, so obviously I was aware of Kubrick and people who love Kubrick in that field, but also, as you know, in the conspiratainment field of you know, YouTube videos about conspiracy theories and stuff, Kubrick pops up an awful lot. And I would say the most interesting Kubrick currently, in terms of sheer numbers and websites and stuff, is probably, in fact, definitely, is in the conspiratainment crowd, or the synchromystics, and or there's an overlap, if they're still around, who are looking for clues to the riddles of the universe in Kubrick. And I knew a lot of those people, or some of those people, and so he just kept coming up and bugging me is the answer. And so I kept going back to look at the guy, and then I started to come up with a theory about him, and then I started to test the theory, and the more I did, the more interesting it got, and the more it extended into these other areas, as you mentioned, that are genuinely interesting to me, and I think genuinely much more relevant to all of us than Kubrick per se, although I try and succeed to make Kubrick more relevant, just in a very different way.
Well, I used that little part of the introduction where I said, in case you don't know, and rattled off a few films. I did that, I think, because I thought about what you just said. I've spoken to a few people in just casual conversation about the man and his films since we began the process. You know, you sent me the book, et cetera, et cetera. And I found quite a few people knew the film titles, but not the guy's name. They couldn't tell you what this guy had done. It might have rung a bell, and a lot of these are younger people as well.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about, in their 20s, early 20s, so like much younger than you or I. You know, the sort of age of, if we had kids, that they might be now.
Yeah,
and it reminds me of, like, you know, currently, for example, maybe the position that they're in with somebody like Kubrick is how I might find myself with what's popular in cinema now. For example, all of these Marvel and superhero films, I have no idea who directed any of these things in recent years, or who worked on them, you know, who produced them. I couldn't tell you a single thing about the minds behind them. I can infer things from the evidence, but I don't know. So that's why I did it, because it was like Stanley Who sort of thing. And I know you said amazing, but there it is, you know. So
it's really perhaps not that amazing. And maybe a better analogy would be somebody like Sandra Bernard or Fatty Arbuckle, or somebody who was huge in to the generations prior to us, or Errol Flynn, say, to name somebody that at least some people have heard of still. But yeah, of course, time moves on.
But that's interesting to consider that. Maybe we don't have time to do that now, but just in the light of everything you've been saying about your work and what you're reaching towards, that there, because I found this a lot, not just, you know, in the recent conversations, but because I work with a lot of people that are a lot younger than me, at least a generation difference. But I mean, I'm very interested in culture and media, and I've learned to sort of not take for granted that they've heard of things that I don't. Everybody knows Pink Floyd, The Wall. You know, what do you mean you haven't heard of War of the Worlds? You know, the album, you know, that type of thing. And it's just these blank looks, and I'm even taken aback sometimes. Have you heard of The Cure? You know, your Sisters of Mercy? No, just blank looks. So that's I've kind of trained myself to not make those assumptions.
Yeah, well, it seemed like a good thing when you first said it, but of course, it's just different strokes for different folks, or new drugs on the market. Really, it doesn't mean that people aren't addicted to being
Something
manipulated
else.
by propaganda. It's just
Oh no, not at all. And of course, because somebody doesn't know who Stanley Kubrick was, or may not have heard of a particular film if they sit down to watch, it doesn't mean they won't be affected by it in some way.
Or that they're not being influenced by him. Like, people have not heard of Crowley doesn't mean they're not being influenced by him, because of course they might listen to the Beatles, and people who've not heard of the Beatles are being influenced by the Beatles because all of modern pop music's been influenced by the Beatles. So it's really, and this would get us right to the subject I mentioned in the email, which is the metaphysical influence of entities. It gets to that, like, that's all of the cultural artifacts are secondary, they're causes with hidden effects, I would say.
Something that came to mind when I started reading your book, and I spent many years, over 25 years, in the music business, music journalism, music writing, and there was this phrase that I was very familiar with. I thought of it in relation to Kubrick, and that was, you know, I would often hear about, he's a musician's musician. You see what I mean? It was coded language. It was a bit like we used to, it was a bit avant-garde. It was sometimes coded language for this is bollocks. But, oh, no, he's a musician's musician. You know, it's a bit like someone trying to argue that Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music is actually, an unheralded masterpiece, that type of thing. You know, you have this Emperor's New Clothes and people, a lot of beard stroking and nodding, a sort of agreement. Well, everyone's just afraid, everyone's afraid to say that, this is crap. And that's not a word used with regards to Kubrick's output, far from it. But and you also mentioned about the kind of Marmite, I think, is what you said about, people are either raving about Kubrick or they're just, the opposite. And it wasn't possible to be, I'm not sure what word you used, but sort of ambivalent. To be honest, that's kind of how I feel about it, about his work. I've not watched any of his films twice, I don't think. Maybe The Shining I've watched twice. I quite enjoyed that. I liked the score. Clockwork Orange was interesting, but it left a bad taste in my mouth. 2001 A Space Odyssey is just boring. And A Eyes Wide Shut, we can talk about that maybe because it's got a bit of a wider implications, I think, certainly in the conspiratainment realm. But again, that was just, I only watched it because I was in a hotel and it was in Iceland and it was the only thing I could find in English. And again, it was just meh. It was completely whatever. You know, I've never owned any of his films. I never had the urge to watch any of them again.
Right.
Yeah, so doesn't mean I'm not affected by it, but that's honestly how I feel. No really strong feelings.
Yeah, well, to me, to my mind, as you maybe know from reading the book, that's a healthy response to Kubrick, and that's how I think everybody would respond to Kubrick if they hadn't fallen into the Kubrickon.
Yeah, well, as you've alluded to, with the devotees, you know, whether they're movie professionals themselves or not, there's this idea of coded information being imparted, embedded in these movies and imparted to those in the know, a bit like sort of schizophrenic voices in some ways. And it's like being a member of a secret society, I'd imagine, in some of these chat rooms and boards and whatnot. And a lot of what you talk about, the oversights in his films, sort of continuity errors, and his contempt or otherwise for the art of filmmaking and the audience. So perhaps you can say something about that, because all of that obsessive seeking for clues, perhaps things that are there, are they not there? I don't know. It reminds me of that whole, people who do things like play Dark Side of the Moon at the same time as the Wizard of Oz, the movie with the sound turned down, and they find all these synchronicities, so-called. But what I mean, what's synchronicity and what isn't? I mean, that's another debate.
It is, yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, just in case anybody is listening who really is a fan of Kubrick, and I'm sure they will be, I've never said that he was contemptuous of. I can't remember the phrase he used, but you know, the art form itself. Kubrick obviously took a great deal of care with his movies. As far as the audience, yeah, I think there was an element of contempt for the audience, or at least, which isn't the same at all, a desire to confound the audience. And that's often associated with a serious artist. And I understand why, and I would agree, but I don't interpret it that way with Kubrick. I think he was up to something else. For some reason, Joyce popped into my head. I've never read Joyce except for Portrait of an Artist's Young Man. He's, of course, very highly regarded, James Joyce, and he filled his books apparently with clues and symbolisms and things that were hard to decipher. And he is considered by the people who get Joyce, or at least claim to, sort of, I don't know if you'd say the writer's writer, but kind of the uber writer, like he's doing something that other writers didn't even attempt. And so that's the general view of Kubrick, at least among filmmakers, I think, but also among these synchronistic types. That he was attempting something and succeeding at something that other filmmakers and other films don't do. And there I agree. However, as far as what he was involved in, I disagree. First of all, I don't think it was him individually. I think he was part of some sort of think tank, and that him and his films were being used instrumentally to further this agenda, which was the creation of artificial intelligence through harvesting of audience attention capture. And secondly, that the movies themselves weren't meant as ordinary movies or works of art. They were meant to be disguised as that, and they were definitely meant to be received as that. And this is where we get the Emperor's New Clothes thing coming in, that there was a major part of the Kubrickon is persuading masses of people, but mainly the gatekeepers and the intelligentsia. And now we have the lower level on the internet who are just self-appointed, not exactly gatekeepers, but they're defining the narrative around Kubrick, or trying to get these people to constantly reinforce or repeat the idea that Kubrick is a great filmmaker, and that these are great movies, and that there's more going on to them than meets the eye, etc., etc. That's a major part of it. If you persuade people, just as, I mean, your example with Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, and The Wizard of Oz, well, if one person or two people do that, and they talk about it, or write about it, or YouTube about it, and they show their own personal evidence that something happens, that there is some correspondence between those two artifacts, other people go away and they try it themselves, and of course they find something because they're looking for it, and then so they add their clues, their evidence, their data point, their experience into the pool, and so it grows and so it grows. So yeah, how much are synchronicities just there innate in the material, and how much are they generated by the perception of the viewer, and not in some quantum mechanics way of shaping reality, although that's a blurry line, but just in the sense of, if you look, you will find, and you will, because you're looking through a particular lens, you're looking for meaning, and so you are more likely to find meaning, because I don't know if I need to explain it, right? You're just trying to interpret everything. So if you try hard enough to interpret the coincidence between an image and a note on an album, you will discover things. But this is one of the points I had about synchronicism, and even the idea of synchronicity. If the meaning of these clues is that the universe, more than the universe, but let's just keep it material, is sentient and intelligent and designed, which any idiot can see, frankly, even Richard Dawkins has to allow that, then it's going to be throughout. You're going to find meaning absolutely everywhere, because that's the nature of existence, is meaning. So what is that? It's a wild goose chase where you're surrounded by wild geese, right? All you're going to find is wild geese, but it's still a wild goose chase, because you don't need to chase wild geese if you're on a wild goose farm. I'm going to leave it there because I did have more to say, but that just seems suitably irreverent, I think.
Well, it's also about assigning meaning as well as it somehow being inherent. Maybe that's something that I never really did, which was I never watched any of Kubrick's films, for example. Well, I wouldn't have had, when I first saw them, I wouldn't have had any information that would lead me to do this. I wasn't looking for anything in particular, very much absolutely face value, you know, which is why I found Space Odyssey to be boring and
exactly.
dull.
I would say that's right. If you look at Kubrick's movies at face value as movies, the way you would go to Jaws, you come away dissatisfied, and rightly. But so people have to watch them over and over again, or at least twice, three times, to get them, in quotes. Right? So that's a big clue. It's not just the standard line is, oh, well, he was ahead of his time. He's doing something you don't, you know. Right, and he's disrupting the normal patterns of cathartic entertainment. Let's say, okay, fair enough. There is a reason to do that. I was never into Beckett or Pinter or these guys, but you know, whatever. I understand there's something they're trying, but that's too standard, I would say. The fact remains that his movies don't really work very well. After from 2001 on, even Dr. Strangelove, in a way, they don't really work that well. The way that movies are supposed to work. Now, I'm not saying that that's like, I'm not saying that Jaws is harmless just because it works on this surface level as entertainment. Of course not. It's still serving to infiltrate, you know, and corrupt us, let's say, or influence us. But Kubrick, I guess he was after higher game. And there's something there that is very central to my argument, which is that you have to, and it's in the art world, and you were kind of circling around it with the Lou Reed analogy. You have to persuade yourself to believe something that you know instinctively is untrue. You have to start. You have to reconfigure your perceptions to enjoy a Kubrick movie. Why? Why would you do that?
Yeah, and again, paraphrasing from the book, the commonplace about Kubrick films is that they do not fare well on first sight. The fact is that all of Kubrick's films require more than one viewing, which I personally, as I said, haven't given to them. And this, what I'm about to say now, might also be something from the book, but why isn't there then the instinctive rejection that you get with heroin or whatever, even with tobacco and alcohol? I mean, I've never smoked, but I like a drink from time to time. But I didn't touch the stuff until I was 20, and I really had to teach myself how to do alcohol, as it were, to get to the point where it was like actually looking forward to having some. So I just wonder why there isn't that instinctive rejection, or maybe there is at some level, but people persist for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, what you're describing is the instinctive rejection. As I say, you watch the movie and you think, "What's going on? What is it? This isn't doing what I wanted." So you smoke a cigarette and you go, "Oh, it's made me feel sick." But if you've got all your friends and stuff telling you, "No, no, keep trying. It's great. Smoking's great." You want to be part of the club, so you keep trying until you get over that natural reaction, aversion, and you end up addicted. I would say that. In that sense, Kubrick is like, his movies are like a gateway drug in that sense to general cultural addiction. Not to say, again, obviously something like Jaws is more obviously that. Like for me personally, I saw that very young and I absolutely loved it, as did my brother. So that was a gateway to just general movie addiction. But I'd say Kubrick is taking the viewer and the experience into a deeper layer, into a second matrix, where a viewer becomes not just addicted to the entertainment value, but personally obsessed with the art form. So a Kubrick file will watch The Shining hundreds of times. Imagine all of that energy and time that's going to, you know, an artifact that basically doesn't change. I mean, it's the same each time you watch it.
Yeah, you mentioned that, well, actually, you used the phrase cognitive impairment, which, and again, if you're watching something like that hundreds of times, what could you do hundreds of times potentially that wouldn't have some kind of effect, let's put it that way? And it was also the cumulative effect that you get. It's not like tabula rasa each time, is it? You've seen The Shining once, you see it a second time. The effects may change. It may be like, I say, cumulative, like smoking one cigarette, smoking 100 cigarettes. You know, doing heroin once, doing it 10 times, and it starts to be deleterious effects. And you mentioned that there's a, quote, a particular sort of intellectual enrapturement that Kubrick's films tend to invoke in people, one that seems to go along with susceptibility to being possessed or programmed by outside influences. And this made me think of something else I was reading at the same time about hypnotism and about, you know, a certain proportion of people that cannot be hypnotized. And certainly that was something that was very much in my mind as we went through the whole pandemic phase, that some people seem to be, I mean, can you imagine COVID-19 directed by Stanley Kubrick? Mm-hmm. It was like some people, you know, most people seem to be very caught up in the narrative, like it was a movie, but they somehow, they found themselves on the screen. And some of us were kind of like, we're watching on, like, we're aware that this is something playing out on the screen. And, you know, we're not, that we have life separate from it. And this is something that the projector has begun, and at some point the reel will run out. But for most people, it's not like that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really have a very clear response to that. Just the mass formation thing, which maybe you've podcasted about, I don't know. And the cult, obviously the cult of Kubrick's there in the title, as is in the attention capture. The desire to... to be, I mean, that I had that experience too around COVID, observing what's called, what is called LARPing, but I used it in this context, live action role play. I do think that people, they've moved into mass formation around the COVID narrative and then around the mRNA pseudo solution, because they had been primed, obviously, in a number of different ways that we could talk about, but here we're talking about Kubrick and movies. They'd been primed by movies and fictional narratives, TV shows about pandemics. I mean, the zombie thing being the obvious thing that really has captured several generations now. But there's no, I mean, there's not an obvious correlation between COVID and zombies, but there's plague at least. And the response is the, you know, the state of emergency and the martial law and the clampdown and that kind of the response thing. It did seem to me very much so that people were, finish the sentence first, but I was just seeing the irony of this, that they were enjoying being immersed in a fake narrative, because I would say it was fake, most of the COVID stuff, or at least it was misrepresented. What I was going to say, but I know the irony that occurred to me, maybe that's enough about that. They just got swept into it. So it wasn't simply fear, it was the enjoyment of dramatizing the fear and stepping up as citizens and conscientious people, whatever, you know, they were motivated by a desire to be virtuous and seen as virtuous and to engage in this collective drama as a crisis. But the irony that occurred to me here was that most of what these people were doing to show that they were on board, that they were participating in the grand drama and being responsible citizens, were staying at home and watching TV and movies and scrolling on their phones, right? So it's very symmetrical. I think there's a great deal in that example, and it brings together the third thing in the subtitle, which is the inception of AI. So we've got, on the one hand, you've got the cult of Kubrick, can be the cult of COVID, just take your pick. Everything is cults, essentially, in terms of people, masses form around some belief and they signal back and forth. We believe the same. We believe the same. And they reinforce it. Like I was saying about smoking. And then you have the attention capture, which obviously there's no cult of Kubrick or COVID or anything without capturing people's attention. But those two things feed into each other. Like the more people, more attention is captured, the bigger the cult, the more attention is being captured. And then, the third thing, which isn't obviously connected, is the inception of AI. And I just connected it in the analogy in that, and it's more and more apparent that people who are masses that are forming into cults and having their attention captured around whatever image or narrative or belief system it is, they're doing so more and more on the internet and on their devices. And that's where AI is feeding, is being informed, is being infused, is gathering data. I mean, it's a bit difficult to talk about AI as an it, but the machinery the hardware, the software, the devices, and the internet itself as this system, soft system, because it's 5G now, so it's in the whole ecosphere, maybe. That it is gathering data and directing it, harvesting, I'm not sure what would you say, concentrating it into something that is potentially moving towards sentience, or moving towards at least some simulation of what people will accept as artificial intelligence.
Well, yeah, talking about that, the way people regarded themselves, you know, during the pandemic period and what was happening around. For many people, they seemed to find meaning in it. That's what I noticed, was that in lives that they were inherently meaningless and characterized by consuming culture and media and, you know, and looking for meaning in all of that, which again, ironically enough, became an even more important part of life under restrictions on 3D, five sensory life, as it were, outside. Again, this may be something from the book, but you have, say, Disneyland, your theme park, which is taken to be fantasy land in order apparently to convince us that what's outside Disneyland is reality. But I mentioned Marvel movies earlier, you know, all the superhero stuff at the minute. And that's almost like the flip side. It's kind of part of the same process. It seemed to be the same processes, you know, the same agendas, whatever. But films like that, I've noticed people who are big fans of this, they see that world as kind of somehow hyper-real, more real than the world outside of the cinema. So, but both those things work equally. You know, people in Disneyland, yeah, this is unreal. When we go back outside the gates, that's reality. And for some others, it's like, well, this life that I'm living, this grey, drab, meaningless, purposeless of nothing, that's not real. But if it could only be like Captain America, you know, if I could have a slice of that, that's what life looks like. That's what reality should be.
Sure. Well, that goes back to childhood. I mean, these are clearly childish narratives that we're talking about with the Marvel movies and Disneyland. I was thinking about that when I was talking about Jaws, but when we were talking about people who go to the movie again and again, and it's the same movie, and it's a bit again ironic or paradoxical, because I think people go back to these things, including even the Kubrick, I mean, or especially the Kubrick people, actually they're going back because they think they're going to discover new things. But essentially what attracts people, I think, to these experiences and to want to keep seeing the same movie again, or in the Marvel case, you don't necessarily have to rewatch the same one, but you've got endless sequels, is they want to recreate the feeling that they had the first time, if at least, I mean, to a lesser extent, it's in the present, as in, you know, the first Iron Man is really good, but then whatever, you know, the sequels get less and less good. So you're trying to recreate the experience of the first one, but I think that's pretty low bar. I think essentially it's trying to recreate an experience of wonder and of excitement. And I would say pre-meaning and pre-purpose, because children don't really have a purpose and they don't have a need for meaning, but they certainly have a sense of wonder and a sense of discovery, and that is their purpose and that is their meaning. So it's pre-need for meaning and purpose. But it's the most, for most people, that's the most lively and enlivened period of their lives. And I explored this a lot in Seen and Not Seen, specifically around the example of Marvel superheroes, because I grew up on those. I mean, that was pretty much my first cultural addiction, I would say. And I still, when I go back to that time mentally, if I look at the covers of the comics that I had back then, I can still feel the wonder that I felt back then. And there's an additional kind of wonder, which is perhaps what many people can relate to, which is just when you connect to any childhood memory, there is a feeling of some mysterious magic around it, partly because it's so far away and it just seems like another life and another world. But I think it's also that we did perceive ourselves and lives, our lives and reality differently. And I would say that these narrative, these fantastic narratives that appeal to children and then to us later as adults, including the COVID thing, as I say, because when did we first see a movie about a pandemic or a global crisis and so on, maybe even as children, that that these appeal to us as children precisely because we're in a period of difficulty in childhood where we're at the very least going to, when we start going to school, but no doubt at home as well, there are problems from day one. And so we are offered these escapes as children into fantasy, even though as an adult, just wandering around, one's town as a child is imbued with wonder, as I say. But as a child, although we have that sense of wonder, we also have the sense of terror and of something that's oppressing us. And so we're combination of trauma and adversity lures us into these traps, I would say, of the entertainment, of the fantasy entertainment. And so we learn very early on to escape into fantasy, or we need to even. And then the kind of fantasy we escape into as children then becomes the kind of fantasy that we want to relive as adults. So somebody who watches, like me, who has watched Jaws many, many times, actually, and I'm amazed every time I watch it, that I have a similar experience of wonder. Well, is it because it's such a good movie? Well, partly, but it's also because I can just transport my consciousness back to the first time I saw it. And there's a continuity because I've kept watching that movie. I probably won't do it anymore, because my whole point here is that this is a trap that traps our attention and keeps us locked in the past, and keeps us returning again and again to the same kind of template of fantasy that we want to escape into. I don't know if I have more on that, but I'll just leave it for now.
Well, that kind of resonates with me in that one of the reasons I just, not quite overnight, but not really gradually either, gave up on the music business, because I just felt that for all the good times and all the sense of achievement, that there was something that I didn't have time for anymore, that there was something more important that I needed to do. And that's not in any way to, I don't have any regrets like that, but it just felt like it was keeping me in. There's new music coming out all the time, but there was something about it that felt like a former life, or that I was repeating patterns, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Something that I needed to break out. It was not quite ever decreasing circles, but it was circles like on a track, and there were, like, a bit like on a motorway, there you do every now and again, you do pass an exit, whether there's signs there or not. You might just want to take a chance and pull off, if the motorway is getting too boring or too congested.
Well, people, I mean, I have addicts in my family, and actually the group work I'm doing currently, I've just started out. It's surprising how much addiction seems to be involved. Well, it isn't surprising, actually, but I'm surprised that I've ended up focusing on it. And the focus isn't, it's not like I'm working with actual addicts, although there may be that too, but different forms, like pornography, for example. I've been asking people about pornography before they join, even, and certainly alcohol and these other things. And just becoming more conscious and more vocal about the fact that we all have these addictive patterns that we return to. And an addict, the thing about an addict, and I've never been an actual drug addict, although I did smoke marijuana for 20 years or something. So I would say that is an actual drug addiction, but it's not exact. Well, it's consistent with the point I want to make. It's just not as really manifest. But so I was thinking my brother was a heroin addict. But so the thing about an addict of a substance is they keep going back to that substance because they know how it will make them feel. So it's exactly what, I mean, that might sound tautological, but I don't just mean, obviously they know how it feels and they want to do it, but I mean, they want to just have control how they are feeling. So it isn't necessarily even that the drug makes them feel that good, but at least when they take it, they know exactly how they're going to feel, as opposed to being in the chaos and the confusion and the uncertainty of just being without stimulants, being without distractions, being without suppressants or narcotics or the opposite, you know, it can be either kind of thing. They want to have control over their internal state, and that's anti-life. That's the anti-life force, I would say, because we can't, like, to be in the flow of life and existence. I know you and I have got into this at times, and I know you like to get into these kind of deeper areas, and I do too. Like, what's the point otherwise if we're not moving to state and experience of wholeness? That to be spontaneously in the flow of existence, you can't have control over how you're going to feel from one minute to the next. It's just being on a roller coaster of existence. It's ironic that movies simulate, or Disneyland simulate, the roller coaster experience, but that's exactly my point. People want to be able to have a roller coaster that they know how long it will last, and that they control when they get on, and they know when they're going to get off, and they compartmentalize the experience of intensity rather than just being in life, which is constantly shifting from boredom, because I think only you have to have something wrong with you already if you get bored, but you know, just nothing much going, contemplative, to intense engagement, even threats, even crisis. That's just a constant process. So the trap that we've been talking about today, and I keep trying to bring it to, is it's in everything that we use and turn to stimulate and simulate interior states of being, and then be able to recreate them. Like we discover, like I was saying about the comic books, I discover those comic books would give me a certain feeling of excitement and belonging and of whatever else, all those things. And then I collected them in a box and I would go back to them, and even specific comics gave me specific feelings. Well, later that becomes movies, and later that might become books, and that becomes drugs, and that becomes sex. Like whatever it is we use to mood alter, we get trapped into the patterns that you were talking about in your music career, and their repetition patterns, and the very nature of them, I would say, is evidence of something that is anti-life and non-human, because human beings, like animals, I didn't want to say other animals, I think we are different, but we have an animal side, but also in common with animals, human beings, I mean, we have cycles, of course. So there's a certain repetition in terms of sleeping and eating, but that's not what I'm talking about. Right? Those are just natural. You can't avoid them, and it would be inhuman to try and break them. These are inhuman because they're trying to regulate and regiment our moods, which no animal ever had a need for. Right? That's a human pathology. And I would say that invisible forces have both created a kind of energy harvesting network around the human energy field or in it to harvest us, and are using our life force to maintain it. It's a very matrix kind of analogy, but that is very much what Kubla Khan and Sema, all of this mapping hell is about. So it's in everything. Okay, yeah. You can, like you brought up the example of the music thing, and how you're getting more of a sense that this is something you didn't want to do. Like anyone and everyone has things that they are stuck in, and what keeps them stuck is that they provide a sense of security and familiarity, and I would say pseudo meaning, but of course it seems real to them. But it's not, because like The Shining, if you keep watching it, it doesn't get more meaningful. Not really, because it's the same movie. So you're just repeating. You're repeating. So you're, in a sense, you're shrinking your reality down.
Yeah, well, everything, that idea of, you know, control of an inner state, you know, you were talking about earlier, when you were talking about people using, you know, substance abuse or use to try and do that because they want to feel a certain way, that's, even if it's not good, it's somehow predictable. But I don't, until you let that stuff go, until your system is flushed, I don't think that you can be aware of what your inner state actually is. And as far as controlling it, I don't think that substance use or culture abuse really does that with your inner state either. You can't really bring it under control that way. If you can control it at all, then yeah, I think you have to be truly aware of what it is, and that's to not have that stuff in your system whenever it happens to be. So yeah. Just however you want to look at it, physically or psychically need us to get clean.
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's what this group work that I'm involved in, that's exactly what it is. So, yeah, you can pollute it and then you feel like you're controlling it. But it's a bit like thinking of Norman Bates or Ed Gein. Like, if you want to have total control over your partner, the only thing you can do is kill them and have sex with a corpse. It's the only way. And so it's like we do that to our interiority. We try to kill it. And then we can control it, but you're controlling a dead thing, so it's worse than no control.
Well, yeah, it's like a dead partner, or you know, a blow up doll from a sex shop, you know, whatever, but perhaps getting in less trouble.
and more real. I mean, that's people actually are doing that all over the world now.
Yeah, well, we could talk about, you mentioned pornography, and that's just that's just part of, isn't it? This great system. The matrix like system of immersion that we're in, you know, food, drugs, culture, the news cycle, you know, pornography, all of some form of debasement, really, in a way. And we're not writing off all forms of culture, music, movies, you know, of course not, or that there's no information external to us that isn't interesting and useful and maybe even wholesome. But we're talking about a certain type. Military entertainment complex is the phrase for it these days, you know, a form of psychological operation, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I am at the point, actually, it won't surprise you, where I am ready to write it off, if not give it up. And obviously, we're using the internet, you're creating podcasts. I'm publishing two books next year. So, you know, are we complicit with this system, even though we're not obvious assets to the military entertainment complex? I would say to some extent we are. You can't not be, because if you have to use those instrumentalities, and when I say instrumentalities, I don't just mean publishing industries or printing presses or the internet. I mean also language itself. Like, if all of this has come from the devil, quote, we can put quotes on or not, then it's all compromised and it's all compromat, right? The devil's collecting compromat on all of us. But what's the alternative? Like, currently, we don't, like, if you're trapped in, I can't use the Matrix analogy anymore, but if you're trapped in a false analogy, which is illustrative of the point we're making, I mean, that movie franchise was so tainted, even just with the sequels, but then with the transgender filmmakers, you know, self-mutilating and all the rest of it, it's just part of something truly horrific. But also because it's become a cliche and so on for a number of different reasons. So it exemplifies what I'm saying, that if you rely on these things to provide meaning or even to give context or to, you know, use them as metaphors or just reference points, then there's a price. There's a price. It's kind of mission creep. Like, there's that saying, you know, if you mention the Nazis in an argument, I forget what it's called, but you lose the argument, right? Because it's too easy. Like, there's a kind of egregore around that, and you just get sucked into some low-level, low-awareness egregore where you're just calling somebody a Nazi to win the argument. Well, that's true of the Matrix. They say use the Matrix and you can't nowadays. It lowers credibility. It makes your point kind of more tainted than useful. So I would say that to a degree, and it's an ironic paradox because we're here to talk about my book, number one, and my book's about culture. So you can't not talk about the thing that's imprisoning you if you're trying to get free, because then it's too much like ignoring it. But there's a trap in talking about it, which thankfully brings me to the point I was trying to get to, because they say this about demons as well. Like, you can, C.S. Lewis said it, but I think there's a tradition in this, that demons have a way to generate obsession in those who do start to become aware of them, as a way to cover all the bases. Because, of course, if people are unaware of them, then they're prey, and they're easy to manipulate. And we live in a world now where demonology, besides, you know, occult circles, which I certainly don't recommend getting involved with those things, even in Christianity, they're basically off the menu. They're not really talked about as a serious issue. So that gives them free rein, and the very culture we're talking about, I'd say, is demon driven. But there are those of us who are willing to talk about these things and willing to explore them. And the tendency there is to trap us with obsession. So everything becomes trapped. But anyway, the point of where I wanted to end on as a response to what you said was that I do think that all of culture, even though some of it clearly has more value and meaning, well, first of all, there's a trap in that because we're using our taste and our discernment to say. So I could say, well, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or even Jaws, or I could go, you know, I could be more arty and I could pick some more marginal work, you know, and say, well, that's pure cinema art, but Kubrick isn't. But I can't do that in good faith because I know that my faculties for discernment have been impaired, have been compromised by my early exposure to these things. So that's one point. But the other point is just also that it's all pervasive anyway. So it isn't, it's like the medium is the message, maybe, that it isn't merely the corporate military industrial entertainment, the powers behind these artifacts that makes them clearly that they have to be identified as propaganda. It's the medium and the media itself which has been shaped by, I have to just keep it short because I'm going on too long, by these invisible metaphysical forces. So what's a full divestment from the influence and the interference of this hidden entity-based energy harvesting grid? It seems to me that it actually is a complete uncoupling from the culture. Now, that's why where I began with you know, exiting from hell and trying to start a farm. I'm not even halfway yet, but just seeing as we are talking theoretically, really, we're having a conversation here. Although I can't walk the talk of this, I do feel that. Certain sense, I mean, once we go into these things and we're willing to keep going, we have to at least consider the possibility that it's all tainted, that it's all no good, that even the urge and the drive to create art itself is a symptom of the fall.
In the book, you quote from the book The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. Is it, not sure how to pronounce that. She says the ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, i.e. the reality of experience, and the distinction between true and false, i.e. the standards of thought, no longer exist. And I don't know when that book was published. It fulfills a number of things for me, that thought, one of which is highlighting artificial boundaries, you know, let's go left, right, division, the where battle lines are drawn in media and culture, between apparently different factions. And the more that you disengage from it and zoom out, a little bit like, again, the pandemic experience that we discussed, the more you withdraw from that and take a sort of a bird's eye view of it, the more it becomes more obvious that it is all just part of one thing and also being orchestrated. It's a little bit like, you know, watching a Punch and Judy show from 6 inches away and then standing back 6 feet and going, oh, hang on a minute, this is a little mock theatre, there's a little stage, there's a guy behind there, you know, none of this is real at all.
I mean, it's about belief, or at least a big part of it is belief, and belief is about suspension of disbelief, and that's the Hollywood term, but to some degree, and Charles Fort said this, to believe anything at all, we have to admit a bunch of data, which is pithy. I mean, it's oversimplified, but there is some, you know, and I'm certainly not, like, it's actually a bit confusing because when you began talking, I don't remember what you said, but I was talking about what Hannah Arendt said, that totalitarianism is about erasing the line between fact and fiction, and yet we're certainly seeing that in today's world. And so my mind naturally goes, perhaps not naturally, but automatically goes to the whole thing, you know, women with penises and 2 + 2 no longer equals 4, the postmodernist woke thing, which is trying to erase that line and say everything is subjective and object. The idea of objectivity is white supremacism or patriarchy. So on the one hand, we got that. I forgot what the other hand was now. I'm pre-associating too much. I was definitely heading. Oh, yeah, a belief. So there are things we need to believe or need to recognize that we know. I don't believe that women don't have penises. I know that women don't have penises, and I'm not going to forget that. You know, nothing's going to make me forget that, fortunately. But some people are forgetting that through sophistry. And they're making themselves suspend disbelief around this whole idea that, you know, of biological sex being a reality. They're no longer believing in biological sex as a reality. And so, although they're no longer knowing it, I don't know what that is. I mean, they're suspending disbelief at the idea that there is no such thing as biological sex, right? Because we just know that. But nature abhors a vacuum. So when they don't believe that, when they no longer know, rather, they no longer allow themselves to be in the knowing, the knowledge of biological sex, which doesn't even require knowledge, you know, it's just experiential, then they have to believe something else. So then they end up believing that sex is a social construct, which of course is a contradiction. It's an inherent contradiction because, you know, sex exists in the animal kingdom where they don't have social constructions. So yeah, there's two things going on here, which are really one thing. One is this erasure of the line between truth and fiction. And the other is people believing things that they know to be untrue. It is the same thing said differently, isn't it? And that, as I say, quoting Charles Fort, to some degree, we're all in that trap. All of us, to some degree, unless we're fully clear, are believing things that at some level we must know to be untrue. So that's where I like to take this conversation. It's easy to talk about woke-tards and people who believe things that are just manifestly false. It's even easy to be dismissive for people who believe that the moon landing is real, even though I can't be sure, but I just think it's silly to believe that with all the evidence, right? But all that's low-hanging fruit. The high-hanging fruit that we need to reach for, I think this is an unfortunate metaphor with Garden of Eden and all, but is where are our own beliefs deceiving us, or where are we dependent on beliefs ourselves, where we needn't be and we need not to be. So we all had this phrase, crucial fictions, that I coined around Whitley Strieber and The Prisoner Infinity when I was writing Prisoner Infinity. Crucial fictions are things that we need to believe in order to get up in the morning, figuratively speaking, in order to cope, in order to keep the terror of reality at bay. Various aspects of reality are terrifying, but I'd say reality itself is terrifying to the false identity, because the false identity isn't real. So it's annihilation, essentially. Reality annihilates everything that is unreal, and that includes all beliefs, because beliefs by definition are unreal. Like, if you don't know something, why believe it? Well, the only reason is you need to. And why do you need to? Well, there's a number of different answers there, but one of them that we've circled around today is that you're part of a mass formation. You're part of a club that you don't even remember becoming a member of, and you need to keep signaling and fortifying or reinforcing the beliefs you have that maintain your membership in that club. But that can extend, you know, to you and I. Like, we're not really part of the club, but I'm doing group work, let's say, and you've expressed interest in that. So the small group of people, I have to watch out for that as the person who's leading the group. And that one of the purposes of the group is to keep discovering and exposing, I would say, entities here, that beliefs are like entities, or they relate to entities, things that possess us and control us. Well, that's a good analogy, isn't it? Because both beliefs and entities do that, observably in the case of beliefs and traditionally in the case of entities, to look at that, you know, constantly with individuals and small group. I mean, I'd only ever be part of a small group, and perhaps you're the same way. What are the things that we lean on to avoid falling down, essentially, but really falling down to the ground, thinking of Icarus now, of reality, you know, just the hard rock, the bedrock of reality, which is where we want to get, but where to bring it back to your non-question, but the points you were making, that the whole global agenda, which became so visible with COVID, is about uncoupling human beings individually and collectively from the bedrock of reality and their sense of reality, because you can't be connected to reality without having a sense of it. So you can't actually disconnect people from reality, although they're trying to do that, of course, with the infiltrations into the human body and transgender and mutilations and all that. But you can hack into or interfere with, block their sense of reality, and then they'll behave in ways that are more and more disconnected from reality, and eventually they will be cut adrift. And then you have, it's like poaching, you know, or shooting fish in a barrel. You have complete control, but like I said about the dead, if you make people dead, you control them. That if people are completely disconnected from any reference or any conscious way of referring to reality, then of course you can completely dictate their reality to them.
Okay, well, we're going to do a part two of this, and we're going to get into much greater detail, points spinning off from the comments that you've just made. That's the harvesting of human sentience for the seeding of machine intelligence, gathering data from the species and importing it to a machine database. Just a closing thought from me. The question then, I suppose, of this reality that we find ourselves part of, that I've increasingly pondered, is that, is it somehow inherently evil, or has it gone wrong somehow?
Yeah, well, that's the traditional theological interpretation, isn't it? Something that was created very good went horribly wrong.
Yeah, because even in the Bible, in one reading of it, can be that there was an original creation, but it was deemed by the creator to be unsatisfactory, a bit like imagine spores in a petri dish in a lab, that somehow something else gets in there that's not supposed to be there, so the scientist throws it out and starts again. So you can read the Bible sort of a narrative in that way. Original creation, God decides not happening, throw that out, destroy it all, start over. So yeah, that's definitely part of it, as opposed to it being somehow inherently evil. You know, the idea of a prison planet, or whatever, however you want to use it, some kind of coarse reality that we descend into for whatever reason, and suffering is all that there is. To maybe to some end, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm not going to respond because I think you're trying to wind up, so otherwise it won't be possible.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. We'll get to all of that next time. So, as mentioned at the top of the hour, your new book is entitled The Kubrickon, The Cult of Kubrick, Attention Capture, and the Inception of AI. I think people can buy that pretty much anywhere that they buy.
Well, actually, they should. They really should, not a word I use often, but they have time to, it depends how long it takes for this to come up, to buy it somewhere other than Amazon at hopefully a competitive price, which is at the actual publishers, Aeon Books, because then there's a code, KU20, but maybe you can put a link to this. So if they do that, they won't be giving their money to Jeff Bezos and the that thing. And hopefully it'll be a decent, it's 20% off anyway.
Yeah, well, this will be out within a time of recording. This will be out, you know, within sort of 48 hours or so. So hopefully that kind of code will still apply. But yes, there'll certainly be a link on the interview page for this if people wish to go there and pick up the book. Is there anything you'd like to share before we sign off for today?
This has been the easiest interview about the Kubrickon so far, because we hardly had to talk about Kubrick, which is great. As I said, mentioned at one point during this conversation, or more than one point, I'm doing online group work and one-to-ones, and so I really encourage any listeners who've felt any kind of thread of attraction or meaning to just reach out and contact me directly to get involved. That's jason@protonmail.com. Because to be frank with you, Greg, and with everyone else, that's the only reason I do any of this. The only reason I write the books and the only reason I do the interviews is to actually to have the real-time connection with other souls, because I feel that the ship of humanity is fast sinking. I think God might be at the point of making the same decision again, just time to destroy everyone and start again. So I really think it's all hands on deck right now.
Okay, well, splendid. Once again, Jason, thanks so much for being with us today, and we'll catch up again very soon, part two.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.